This meeting is now being recorded.
Can everyone hear me now?
Yep, sound fine.
Okay, great. So I did my graduate work at the University of California, Santa Cruz with Joel Premack, where Rachel Somerville was a graduate student with me, where some of this work was started. I then did a postdoc with Avishai Dekel at University of Jerusalem, and a postdoc with Neil Katz, University of Massachusetts Amherst. And since then, I've been faculty at New York City College of Technology, which is part of the City University of New York.
And for how long have you been at CUNY?
It's around 10 years now.
Okay, good. All right, I think we're set up. And Avi, have you given Ari control?
I think I have. Ari, can you control it?
Let me try so we can move. Yep, looks good here.
Okay. All right, let's get started. And then once again, folks, thank you all. As you all know, we archive these presentations, audio and the presentation materials, on the Louvoir seminar site. So from time to time, Ari, and I'll remind you if you forget, could you note which page you are on for the folks who will be just listening to the audio in the days and weeks to come? So again, Ari, the floor is yours.
Okay, thank you. So we just... Okay. Okay, thanks everyone. I'd like to talk to you about some of the new research we're doing if damp-bomb alpha systems modeling at very high redshift, but I will introduce that with some of the history of these systems and the role they've played in understanding cosmology and galaxy formation better. And I think it also makes it quite clear that what's going on now is kind of a continuation of what's been going on for a very long time. So if anyone's not familiar, damp Lyman alpha systems are the highest column density hydrogen absorption systems. They have column densities greater than 2 × 10⁰ atoms per square centimeter. And what makes them special, or one of the things that makes them special, as you can see from the example spectra, is that they're so high column density that the damping wings are visible and measurable, which allows the an observer to measure column density. For lower column density systems, there tends to be some uncertainty as to the difference between column density and other factors that give you the width of the absorption system. But for these systems, we can measure the column densities directly. And the other thing about them, which has been very interesting, is that at these column densities, at least locally, the only objects that reach these column densities are the cold gifts of galaxies. Intervening material, material in the IGM or between galaxies or even stuff like high velocity clouds never reach these high column densities. So we feel pretty confident that when you see one of these systems, you're looking at some gas that's cooled into a galaxy. So from a theoretical perspective, the real importance of these systems is they give us a direct measure of the amount of cold gas in dark matter halos at high redshift. And while we can see some galaxies and continuing to find more and more galaxies at very high redshift, the galaxies you see are very biased by the brightest objects. Why here in this measure of cold gas is a more kind of uniform or less bias towards star formation, a more kind of story of what the whole universe is doing kind of in a fair representation. And so just measuring these systems gives you constraints on cosmology right away. In fact, hot plus cold dark matter was essentially ruled out because in such a cosmology, there's not nearly enough halos at high redshift to host these systems. And just the number of observed damp bomb alpha systems tells you there must be at least this many halos at a given redshift in order for it to be cold gas. In the early attempts to use cosmological hydrodynamical simulations, again, this was a large challenge. Those simulations did not see as many of these systems as you would expect, and the authors of those papers basically said, well, if you continue down to the unresolved regime to much lower mass halos, then maybe you can account for all that gas. and maybe we can, you know, have a consistent picture. But you have to go down to quite low mass halos in order to do that. Now on the slide, the DLAF kinematics, that was the picture, but then observations, as is often the case, showed us that there was a serious problem with the picture. A series of papers by Wolf and Prochaska studied the kinematics of DevML systems and found that these systems had very large velocity widths and evidence for multiple components. So the idea that these things could be in very small halos and have very small sizes seemed to be completely contradicted by their observations. They proposed the model that these systems were large, very thick disks, and then when lines of sight passed through it, you would get a very large velocity spread and the multiple components could come about because of the thickness of the disk. That picture really challenged the ideas of CDM because in the basic kind of framework of CDM, structure grows over time, and so, you know, you would hope that things a long time ago, 10 gigayears ago, wouldn't be as large as they are today. So an alternative was then suggested where instead of thinking of these as one large system, we think of them as multiple component systems. Instead of thinking of a single gas disk, we think of, you know, a number of galaxies and proto-galaxies coming together and the damped Lyman alpha systems being a combination of these different sight lines. So in the next slide, you can see a toy kind of picture of that, where we basically used a semi-analytic model that was developed by Rachel Somerville and Joel Primack to try to account for star formation and gas cooling in the universe. And we then essentially tried different models of how the gas is distributed in those halos and subhalos, and then measured the kinematics of the damped Lyman alpha systems we observed to see what would be needed in order to get consistency with the observations. And so the positive is we found we could find models where we could match the kinematics that were seen by Prochaska and Wolf. But the difficulty was that the gas disk has to be fairly large. If you have small gas disks, then essentially the chance of hitting multiple systems is very small. So you see in the picture in projection, you have overlapping parts of the gas disk. In this picture, the shaded region is actually the part that has a column density high enough to be a damped Lyman alpha system. But the black line shows other gas that extends out from that at lower column density, which when added to a damped Lyman alpha system gives you a larger velocity width than the multiple components. So from that study, we can get a sense of the distribution of where do damped Lyman alpha systems come from. And that's shown in the figure where you see a distribution in terms of the circular velocity of the halos. And you see that there's a peak at about 100. There's some contribution from very massive systems, halos that go up to about 300 kilometers a second. There's some contribution from slightly less massive halos at around 80 kilometers a second, but then it quickly drops off. So that low mass halos essentially contribute nothing to the damped Lyman alpha cross-section. And that's essentially required by the observations that these systems have large velocity widths. There's simply no way very small systems that have circular velocities of 30 or 50 kilometers a second, can give you the large velocity widths that you see. And so if they contribute any significant part of the population, it's very hard to understand how you get the velocity width. So in order to make the velocity widths combine with the numbers you see, you have to have fairly large systems in more massive halos.
Question?
Yes.
In most cases, when people talk about halos, they're talking about dark matter halos. You're talking about H1 halos. Is that correct?
No, I'm talking about the dark matter. When I say halo, I'm talking about the dark matter halo too. The H1 halo is very low column density and doesn't really contribute to damped Lyman alpha system. So in all these cases, we can see in the next figure, I should show you a nice picture. So I'm talking about the halo, the dark matter halo, which is shown here, the large dark matter halo that all these systems are in by the thick dashed line. And then you have subhalos with each one having a galaxy, and the galaxies have the cold gas disks. So I always mean I'm always going to be talking about dark matter halos, not the gas halos of these galaxies. Well, actually, right now I'm talking about the gas halos, but in general, I'm talking about dark matter halos. So I just want to follow up what I just discussed with the fact that we followed up that paper with another paper where we tried to model not only the core gas in the galaxy, but also the hot gas that contributes to high ionization state lines. And so this toy model you can see here in the picture, you basically have a big extended cold disk, and then that is in the main halo and all the subhalos. So you have, you know, a set of galaxies like the Milky Way with our satellite galaxies. But then each of those also has some hot gas that surrounds it. And the hot gas, why it contributes very little, almost no H1 because of its temperature, does contribute in other high ionization state metal lines like silicon 3 or carbon 4. And part of the observations that were done by Krasky and Wolf was to compare these lower ionization state lines that probe cold gas with these higher ionization state lines that produce hot gas. And so this model where we basically thought the hot, you know, you can see that the hot gas knows about the cold gas, but it's not exactly the same. Some lines of sight would be, example, on the alpha system, but you can have a line of sight through this object, that never has any cold gas and only has hot gas contributing to it. These combinations of different possibilities give you a distribution of different, ionization velocity widths and structure. I bring this up mostly because this really hasn't been done since this point, and there's actually a lot of information about how hot gas and cold gas are related, which I think needs to be explored further. Why people look at cold gas or people tend to look at hot gas, the relationship between the two is not as pursued as it could be. Okay, so that's some background. That's all, most of that work I just described took place about 15 years ago. So you may ask, well, what's new in this field? In the last 15 years, hydrodynamical simulations have essentially done much better at being able to produce these systems over a series of improvements to codes and with the fact that we now have the Lemon CDM model as the certain model, which makes things much better because there's much more time for there to be halo growth, so there's more halos and high redshift. A series of simulations essentially are able to reduce both the number density and the kinematics of these systems between redshift 2 and 4. We also looked at this again with a more up-to-date semi-analytic model done by Mike Berry, who is a student of Rachel Somerville, and that's what I'm going to talk about now, just to give you our update on that. This new model is based on the Semmelweis models of Somerville et al. 2012. But in addition to that, what was added was an attempt to partition the gas into atomic and molecular hydrogen. This is, you know, realistically actually what happens, though often in both Semmelweis models or hydrodynamical simulations, this detail is not resolved because it tends to be a high-resolution issue to try to resolve. But we probably is relevant in star formation, which is what this Popping et al. Paper and Somerville et al. Paper discussed in star formation rates when using this model. And it makes sense that it will also be important in what you actually see in depth by alpha systems, since you're only looking at atomic gas. Gas density molecular state doesn't show up in the H1 line. And in particular, this has always been proposed as an important thing for damp-long alpha systems to explain why there's not very high column density systems. At very high column densities, you expect the gas to move to molecular state, and so you have a natural reason why the column density distribution doesn't continue up to extremely high column densities. So if we look at the results of that, this figure from Berry et al. 2014, shows a whole bunch of different models, which I won't go into in detail, but essentially the black points are the data, the colored points are the models, and what you see is the distribution of column densities, which drops off and then continues to drop off quite sharply when you get to very high, highest column density systems, and there basically are no systems seen that are called densities greater than 10 to the 22. And you see that because of us adding this gas partitioning, essentially the data points behave like the observational points and the model points behave very similarly. At the high column densities, they both tend to drop off. And this is simply because those high column densities, the gas is converted to molecular, and so the H1 column density goes down. So the gas partitioning does what we would expect. It basically means that you don't get very high column densities. If you don't include this, then those models tended instead to kind of be kind of flat and overproduce by factors between a few and 10 these very high complexity systems. So gas partitioning into molecular and atomic, probably the explanation for why the complex distribution of these systems turns over. Any questions?
Doing well, keep going.
Okay. So that comes to the next point, which is we can look at the number of these systems we see. If we model these systems with the normal sizes given by the SAM, we produce two few systems. That's the models that are have a 1, so the solid red line in both cases is the kind of default model for the sizes of these gas disks, and you see they're far below the actual number of observed systems, which is given by the crosses. So like the story read earlier, we see that if we can extend the size of these systems, if we make them, let's say, 2.5 times the size that you would normally guess, that's the blue lines, then you see that the numbers of these systems you see basically gets to agreement with the data points, at least for redshifts below 3. Now, something that should be quite clear from this figure is that when you go out to redshift 4 and 5, all of the models we're considering are very deficient in the number of deadline mouse systems they see. And that's what I'm going to talk about at the end of the talk. But for now, I want to talk a little bit about the fact that we always are pushed to having these larger gas disks and a little bit of the possible theory that would make this not a crazy, you know, just trying to find any solution we can, but actually motivation that there is a reason to think that the gas disk of galaxy might be much larger than is often naively assumed. All right, and just to show you that with these larger disks, like we showed before, essentially the kinematics, the velocity widths of these systems that you see are in good agreement from this model. So the two models with the regular size disk, the top panel here, the bottom panel, the 2.5 times larger disk, and you see that there's a fairly good agreement with the distribution of velocity widths that are measured. Statistically, they're basically in agreement. This model from Barry et al. For these less than redshift 3 damped anomaly systems does almost all of the basically properties about damped anomaly systems seem to work fine. We get the right number of systems, we get the right column density of systems, we get the velocity width distribution, and the metallicities really for the first time in any of these models agrees well with the distribution and the trend with redshift. So at least for redshift 3 and below, this model seems to be in good agreement with what we know about these systems. All right, now we go back to the sizes. So again, just to summarize where we are, in both hydrodynamical simulations and simulated models, we're basically in good agreement with the properties of damped Laminar systems, but the systems have to be larger than one would naively expect. So what is the naive expectation? Well, the kind of standard model of disk sizes was developed by Fall and Astafiou in 1982, and it basically follows an argument by Mestel that when a galaxy forms, the gas keeps its angular momentum that it starts with and basically stops collapsing when its angular momentum supports it. So much like we think happens in many other systems, essentially the angular momentum determines the size of the disk. Following the staff, you brought in the idea since we first started talking about dark matter halos that you could look at a dark matter halo, measure the angular momentum in the dark matter halo. This is only a theory, not in practice, since we can't actually do that. But at least in a simulation, you can measure the angular momentum of dark matter halo, assume that the gas has its fair share of that angular momentum, so it's a mass fraction of that angular momentum. So then you would know its angular momentum, you conserve it, and that gives you the size of the disk. This model has been updated, you know, since that time with some couple, you know, more realistic halos, more realistic ways about how the gas and dark matter interact and collapse together. But essentially, this is the basic model that determines disk sizes in semi-analytic models. In simulations, you actually have, you know, the physics, so it just does what it does. But at least the comparison in semi-analytic or analytic models, this is the framework that we expect disk sizes to form. However, I think there's a number of issues with this model, and when we consider those, we may not be surprised that the actual size of the disks are somewhat larger. One of the main issues is that model I just described doesn't mention feedback or loss of gas in any way. So in the slide here that's titled, What About Feedback? We know that most of the gas is actually lost from the galaxy or returns to the halo of the galaxy. So we expect that at best, maybe a third of the gas actually makes it to the galaxy. So you lose two-thirds and in many cases 90% or more of the gas either back into the halo or completely out of the dark matter halo. So assuming that this angular momentum conservation gives you a disk size assumes that somehow that feedback doesn't affect what the angular momentum of the gas is. So in 2002 with Alan Scheidekel, we worked on a model to try to see if this actually made sense. Where we came up with a toy model, which is what's shown in the picture on the right, where basically we could just imagine halos, dark matter halos, building up of accreting smaller and smaller objects. Each time you accrete an object, that increases the mass of the halo, but it also increases angular momentum, because there's some orbital angular momentum, which is then converted to the spin angular momentum. And we basically parameterized that so we would get the correct angular momentum distribution of halos. But then we can think about what happens to the gas in those situations. And for most models of feedback, the basic idea would be small halos lose a lot of their gas. Larger halos are able to keep more of it. So if you have a distribution of halos merging and creating a bigger halo, then we would expect that the smallest of them would have a very small gas fraction and the largest of them would have a larger gas fraction. The point of all that is that we also expect that that's a difference in the angular momentum between those two. We expect that the largest mergers give you the most angular momentum, while small mergers, because basically statistically they come in from random different directions, tend to cancel each other out and give you low net angular momentum. So just thinking about the situation in this way, it comes to the natural conclusion that the actual gas that makes your galaxy would preferentially be higher angular momentum than the dark matter as a whole. Later simulations basically found a very similar picture. What you see here in the bottom image is the gas around a forming galaxy. And what the authors, Brook et al. In this case, did was they looked at the which gas stays in the galaxy and which gas gets expelled. So the middle panel shows the gas that's going to end up staying and becoming future stars. The rightmost panel shows the gas that's ejected. And then they calculated the angular momentum of that gas in both cases, and they found that the gas that gets ejected and those outflows preferentially along the poles has low angular momentum. The gas that ends up in the stars has much higher angular momentum. You're not sampling the gas in an unbiased way. The gas that ends up in your galaxy tends to be the higher angular momentum gas. So this will give you more angular momentum or a larger disk than you would get if you assumed that the gas simply had the same angular momentum, specific angular momentum as the dark matter. Now, more recently, we've looked at this issue in some detail about how it is exactly that angular momentum grows in dark matter halos and in the gas. So this is a paper by Stewart et al. But there's also a similar paper, Bishon et al., that uses a different code. We're using the gasoline code, and they were using the Ramsey's code. But we both had similar findings as to what goes on. And you can see that in the panel, this is showing four different halos. So each column is just a different halo. We have four simulations in high resolution. And what you're seeing on the top is the recent Angularentum acquisition. So in the last 150 million years, how much Angularentum came in. And the bottom panel is showing you the total Angularentum of the different components. And then the lines are showing you different stuff that comes in. The black line is showing you dark matter, but the blue line is showing you stuff that accretes in cold mode accretion. In other words, it doesn't shock heat as it enters the halo. And the red line is showing you the hot gas. And you can see why there's lots of variation as different random events occur, that there's a tendency for the cold mode gas to be of higher Angularentum as it comes into the halo. And if you look at the bottom panel, the result of that is accreting higher Angularentum stuff is that the cold mode gas tends to be of substantially higher Angularentum than the rest of the gas. So this is a different argument than the one I just discussed. Before we said, if once you consider the gas in the halo, the high Angularentum gas tends to make the galaxy and the low Angularentum gas tends to get blown out. But here, even before you remove any gas, there's no, you know, feedback isn't playing a role here. This is the gas that's out near the zero rays in the halo. The gas that's coming in as warm gas has higher Angularentum to start with. The next figure shows you a little bit of why that occurs. What you see here is a time-lapse image of the gas. It's an image of the gas, but you're seeing the time it will come into the halo. And what you see is that for cold gas, gas that doesn't shock heat, it has a clear kind of disc-like, not disc, but a rotating structure. This gas is being fed in by along filaments, and so it comes in and basically has much higher Angularentum because it, you know, essentially shows some symbols of rotation. If you look at the gas that comes in hot, that shock heats, this gas isn't associated with coming in through filaments, and so it comes in from every direction and has no preferentialness to its direction or motion, therefore having lower Angularentum. So there's two things that are wrong with the standard assumption about the sizes of gas disks. The first is the gas that comes in to form the disk is not have the same Angularentum as dark matter. It's preferentially higher Angularentum because it's coming in along filaments instead of coming in from every direction. And two, once that gas gets in, there's a preference to have supernova feedback affect the low Angularentum gas more than the high Angularentum gas. Now, before I move on, I just want to mention you may, or it's reasonable to be concerned. I'm showing you the results of halos from one simulation code, but it's a good practice to always say that's the results from one code. How much do we know that those agree when people use different methodologies? So we're currently doing a project where we're comparing a number of different commonly used codes. They basically, we start them all with the same initial conditions of one Milky Way map galaxy, run all the codes with their slightly different aspects of feedback and stuff like that, plus implementation, and then, you know, we get basically five different galaxies, and we can say, is this the same in those different galaxies, or is it code-dependent what you get? So the five codes that we're running are ENZO, which is an AMR code, Ramsey's an AMR code, and ART, which are AMR codes. Also a RAPO, which is a moving mesh technique, and then pressure SPH version of Gizmo, which uses SPH. So these are the three most common methods for solving hydrodynamics, plus there's other code-to-code variations. So looking at all of these codes together should give you a fairly fair sample of what at least most modern cosmological hydrodynamical simulations would give you. And so the results of that can be seen in the figure. So the symbol type is which code is used, and we're basically looking at different snapshots along the evolution of those different galaxies. But the takeaway from this figure is simply that if you look at the black color symbols. That's the dark matter. The dark matter angular momentum gives you a spin of close to 0.05, with some higher, some lower, and some variation as time goes on, because there's is change as you have different types of mergers. And the blue symbols show you the cold gas, the gas that came in and did the shock heat. And you can see that in all these simulations, it's much higher. It's much higher by a factor of 3 to 5 times as much angular momentum comes in with this gas than comes in the dark matter. So just from this, you would expect that, you know, the gas disk that's formed in these galaxies would be something like 3 or 4 times larger than the naive assumption that was being used in simulation models, which would agree completely with what we found in Berry et al. All right, so I've discussed the gas disk sizes and the agreement of these models for redshift 3 to 4 and below. But as I pointed out earlier in our semi-log model, we fell very, very far from being able to get the number of systems at high redshift, the redshift 5. And that's not just a feature of the semi-log models. That's also the case in the hydrodynamical simulations. The plot here shows you the mass density in H1 measured from Dapplemann alpha systems, converted into an omega, just to make it unitless. So the circles and squares are the data points. This has been a fairly new observation that we have this 4 and 5 data point, which is why all the work previously was done, the 2 and 3, maybe up to 4, but this final point here that's near the 5 is new data using Sloan, and that's why all the models are not prepared to meet it. In this figure, the solid blue line shows you the Dapplemann alpha systems they find in the simulation, which you see is, you know, very far below the points at 4 and 5. The purple line is all the H1 gas. So if it's not in Dapplemann alpha systems 2, you can still see it's very far below. And they conclude, which should sound familiar to you now, that if you would have to go to a lower resolution, so below what the simulation can resolve, go down to halos that are only 10 to the 7th solar masses, and extrapolate how much H1 gas they have if you want to be able to get the observed H1 that's actually seen. That's the cyan line. So you see that this problem of falling short at high redshift is happening both in simulations and in SAMs, and the reason is not surprising. There's simply fewer and fewer halos as you go to higher and higher redshifts. And so what's really surprising is that the observations show no decline. So, you know, all CDM-based models would expect there to be less stuff at some higher redshift, and the fact that the observations don't show that isn't inherently a tension with CDM. Now, we can try our usual plan, the what's worked so well for us before, which is simply to make the disk bigger and hope that as they get bigger, they get more cross-section and we get closer to the observed points. So that's what's shown here. This is the same model used in Berry et al. And now all we've done is we simply scaled up those disks that started 2.5 times what was normally assumed, and now we've made them, you know, twice as big or 4 times as big. The red line here shows half as big. What you can see is that you get very little increase in the number of systems you see. If you're wondering why the data points, the crosses, look different than they did in the last plot, that's because the previous plot was in log. So this is linear, so you can see that there is about a factor of 2 increase in the density of these systems, which in log, they basically look pretty flat. And you can see that changing the size is not really increasing the number of systems we see. You can understand why that's the case. It's simply that the central density of these gas disks is far above the Dapplemann alpha threshold for most cases. And so if you make the disk bigger, the effect of that is to bring the central density down. So for example, in this plot, the black line shows you if you just take the normal scale, If you increase that by a factor of 1.5 or 2, you get the dotted line or that dot dash line. So the central density goes down. The central density is lower. The disk is more extended. But if you look where the damped Lyman alpha threshold occurs, that 20.3 in the log, which defines the damped Lyman alpha system, then the changes are fairly small, of order 5%. And so, you know, scaling your disk up or down is not really going to make much of a difference unless you make the disk so big that the whole thing drops below the damped Lyman alpha threshold. So scaling is not going to get us very far. Instead, you have to basically change the profile. So what's also shown as the green and red line is a power law profile, something that goes as 1 over a constant plus R to the power of 1/2 or to 1. This creates a much flatter on the outside disk, and so you can see it increases the amount of cross-section of the damped system. Much bigger increase, so you get an increase of 30 or 40%. However, based on the plot where you saw we were a factor of, you know, 20% or something too low, that increase is not going to be enough. And in fact, if you go to the extreme of just making the disk uniform density at 20.3, so this is the biggest possible cross-section you could have in damped systems with that amount of mass. Can't get any bigger. That gives you the cyan line, and you can see that with the H1 we have in the model, that's still below the actual data points. So you're forced to the conclusion that there has to be more cold gas than we're assuming. There's no way, no change in profile and size of these objects will possibly get you to the number density you see at redshift 5 with the amount of gas that we have. So the advantage of using some of those models is you can just change things as you want arbitrarily and see what happens. So we decide to look at that. Instead of taking the amount of mass that's according to the model in H1, we can take all of the gas, the molecular and the atomic and the ionized gas, and say, okay, for some reason we don't yet understand, all of that is instead atomic. All of it contributes to the H1 density. And that would give us the red line as opposed to the green line. So you see that that does increase the number of these systems by something like 50%. But you can also see that that's still far short of what we need. We need an increase of more like 500%, not 50%. If we take all the stars and we say, okay, we don't understand star formation at all, let's say none of those stars formed and all of their hydrogen is instead just neutral atomic hydrogen. That has a very small effect because there's very little star formation at these high redshifts. So essentially that line is the same as just including the gas. If we say, okay, we don't understand feedback, maybe our feedback model is much too efficient. So let's say that half of all the gas that could be there is there. So our feedback is weaker than we're assuming. That gives you the purple line, and you can see you're still very, very, very far below. In fact, any model that stays in exponential disk for the profile falls far short of what you need. The only way we can find a model that will actually give us the observed number of systems at redshift 5 is to combine both, including much more gas in the disk than is in the model. So basically feedback is much less effective and only removes a much smaller portion of the gas. And to redistribute the gas in a power law so it has a much longer tail of low column densities but right above the cutoff to damped Lyman alpha systems. And if we do that, if we use 25% of the possible bare ions that are available, make them all into neutral hydrogen. So, you know, this is there. If there's anything else, it could be an ionized, it could be a molecular, it could be in stars, all those other things. We're only putting 25% of all possible baryons into just neutral hydrogen. You see with the right power law, that's what it would take to reach the redshift 5 line density. I'm not sure that's a realistic model. It just gives you a sense of what it is that you need to do. But it also, you can see from these lines, makes it quite clear that if you do that in Redshift 5, in order to agree with the number of systems we see, you can't do that much below Redshift 5, because then you'll way overproduce the number of damp line mapping systems. So you're in an interesting situation where it's possible to change the model so drastically it reaches the observed numbers in Redshift 5, but you can't continue on that way. Now you can see that you're at twice as many as observed in Redshift 4 if you continue the model on in that way. And so the main conclusion that I'm trying to make at this point is that something fairly dramatic has to happen to the amount of cold neutral gas that's in in dark matter halos that happens somewhere between 4 and 5 and really changes the way gas is in these halos. And that's something that doesn't exist in any current theory of galaxy formation, but I think that this data basically drives us to find some method to do that. So I can get to my conclusions already. Basically, it's possible to match the number density of damp systems at redshift 5, but doing so requires radically changing the amount of hydrogen that's currently what we get from galaxy formation models. And I'll remind you that these models are doing fine at redshift 3. So at redshift 3, these assumptions about gas cooling, feedback, star formation, and the various states of gas look very good from redshift 3 down to redshift 0. But at redshift 5, they totally fail. So what are the choices we have? Basically, feedback for some reason could be much less efficient at redshift 5, so that these galaxies have much, much more cold gas than galaxies do at redshift 4 or 3. And the disks are very extended in some way that, again, is not kept at lower redshift. And there's a way to just kind of squeak in and make that work, but then you'd have to have things change and return to our kind of normal model by redshift 4 if you don't want to vastly overproduce the number of systems at redshift 4. The other possibility is that lower mass halos than the ones we've been looking at here, contribute a substantial amount of the gas at redshift 5. That allows you to bring much more gas in. But again, you have the same problem. Unless those halos lose their gas at redshift 4, you'll also vastly overproduce the number of systems at redshift 4. So both, it could be a combination of these two things, but both scenarios entail a different understanding for how gas is cooling and staying cold in halos that occurs at this epoch, at redshift 5 to redshift 4. The nice thing is that future observations should be able to clarify this in a number of ways. In particular, so the only real information we have of these high redshift systems is their number. But if we have more information on the column density distribution and the velocity lift, just like earlier, that helps us to determine which halos are actually giving rise to these systems, those measurements at redshift 5 would do the same thing, and it would make it clear whether low-mass systems are contributing a substantial amount. And the column density distribution also tells us about the profile, whether it's shifted, it's changed, or it's similar to what it is at redshift 2 or 3, which would tell us whether the disk can be extended and have a very different gas profile than they do now. So I think this is a very exciting avenue of research to look forward to in the next few years, and I think it presents right now a serious challenge to all of the currently used models of galaxy formation. People, and that's what we're pursuing currently, need to try to adjust things at these very high redshifts and then connect that to what goes on at lower redshifts without messing up everything else that their models do. And it's not clear how challenging or easy that will be at this point. So I thank you for your interest and I'll take any questions if you have any.
Thank you.
Sounds good. Thank you, Ari. We do have some questions here, and of course, also, if folks on the phone have questions, feel free. Go ahead.
This is Mark Rafelski. I had first a question and a few comments. For the Redshift 5 point for L of X and Omega H1, are you using the Notre Dame 2012 paper, or what data are you using for comparing to the models?
Yeah, that's the 2012 paper. There's been a little bit more since then, but it hasn't really changed what the points are.
Okay. So I caution the use of that data point because if you look at Rafelski et al. 2014, a lot of these low signal noise Sloan data were followed up with higher resolution spectra, and it turns out that the higher density of Lyman alpha forest and the low signal noise results in Lyman limit systems and just Lyman alpha forest lines mimicking damp Lyman alpha systems, and they can't tell. And so it turns out actually most of those systems aren't DLAs, and there's a work by Neil Crichton et al., 2016, that tried to do this very carefully, and they find a flattening and potential downturn at Redshift 5. And some preliminary work of mine suggests maybe even that you've got a downturn as you go Redshift 5. So I would, I guess as a comment, be a little careful of overinterpreting the data at Redshift 5 right now, and that perhaps that would explain why you're having trouble reproducing them in the simulations.
Yeah, that's a very interesting result, which we'll definitely take a look at. I would just say that that even if you get a flattening, we still have a lot to go. So if it comes down some, we still have to go up some. So I feel like it's still a good amount of tension, though it will make it much easier if it comes down by a factor of two. It's definitely we're much closer to, we have to do less adjusting, but I don't think there's any way it's coming down as low as where models currently are.
Good, thank you. Do folks have other questions?
I have a question online.
Sure, yeah, go ahead. And
this is Andrew Falk.
Yep, sure, go ahead.
Hey, Ari, this is great work. I had a couple of quick questions. You talked about the line density of the high redshift DLAs. I wondered if your models can predict other DLA properties such as metallicity, because that's something where Mark has data as well. So there's other things you can look at as well as DN by DZ.
Yeah, definitely that's the case. So for, you know, I didn't show the metallicity, but the Berry et al. Paper looks at metallicity and the convex distribution and velocity lists and all that for the redshift, you know, two to three system. The reason we haven't looked at that yet at the very high redshift is because we first want to get a model that gives us, you know, some possible explanation for the numbers, and then we can look at the metallicities of those systems. But we have all that information.
Okay. And the other thing, if I can, I agree with the point you made early in your talk that the hot gas in DLAs, the high ions, hasn't received as much attention as the low ions. But I wanted to point out there's plenty of data, so that there's lots of observations of carbon 4 and 06 in these systems, and they show different kinematics from the low ions. So there's no shortage on that side. I think it's really just the theory and the modeling of what's producing the hot gas is where the opportunity for more work is.
I completely agree. If I didn't make that clear, that's definitely the point. The observers, including yourself, are have lots of data, and it's definitely us who have not risen to the challenge of trying to explain it. So that is what I meant. That the on both the simulation and semiolytic fronts, we should be trying to better understand what's going on here. And with all the data you have, we really can do a great deal. And that's something we need to pursue to a much greater extent.
Okay, thanks.
I have one more comment. This is Dino from Goddard. One other aspect that we've been pursuing these days is also looking at DLAs along gamma ray bursts. Those are very peculiar environment because you might think that at any redshift they trace star forming environment. So not only you get the DLA H1 column density, but also you have information on the low and high ionized gas around this star forming environment. And the metallicity especially at high redshift in this recent work that we did with Mark and others last year, also shows a strike difference in between the Middle East, the redshift 3.5 and beyond that. So I think that's also another line of research that is worth pursuing, especially because when you look at the DLAs at any redshift for the GRBs, you know exactly what the DLA host galaxy is because it's that GRB host galaxy itself. And so you also can go back and look at the star formation and the properties of the halos of those galaxies, DLAs, compared to the quasars ones that are more difficult to find.
Yeah, I completely agree. The work with GRBs is very interesting and very useful, especially for this comparing the galaxies. I should point out that there's a follow-up paper, which is Berry 2016, which just came out, which is about just that. It's about the optical properties of the galaxies in the model compared to the gas properties, so that one can do exactly what you said. Again, preferentially with the GRB selected one, since you'll be able to actually see what kind of galaxy you have. So we have looked at making model predictions about that, but it would be but definitely the GRBs are very helpful in that regard. And the differences between GRB DLAs and quasar DLAs is something that we need to address. And this unfortunately haven't succeeded in any models that I can explain those differences yet, but it is one of the most interesting things about these systems at this time.
Yeah, just on the same line, I wasn't aware of that paper. Actually, I'm just putting up the paper itself on my laptop. We have a paper in progress with Mark and Agrassians in Maryland here at Goddard, specifically addressing this question that you asked. So we're going to definitely look at the paper. Essentially, what we're looking at, we are collecting all the data sets available for GRBs galaxies that host DLAs redshift above beyond 2 and try to extrapolate all the properties of these galaxies. So having a model to compare with would be very useful. So maybe we can get in touch later for chat about this.
Yeah, I'd be very happy if you email me what you guys have. I'd like to discuss it more. That'd be great.
Good questions. All additional questions, folks? Good. Any closing observations, Ari?
No, I mean, I just wanted to share. I think it's a very interesting place we're working at. It seems like there's a number of people there doing stuff, and I think more conversation is definitely will hopefully help us understand this.
No, and that certainly would be welcome. Yes, there are a lot of people here at Goddard doing stuff. Nicely said. Very good. Thank you. And again, I'm just about ready to end the audio recording. So again, which hangs up everybody. So thank you all. And especially Ari, thank you also earlier about 2 hours ago practicing. We're still working through the little bugs and uncertainties of this new technique to maintain this, to host these seminars. So again, thank you for your patience, Ari.
Thank you.
Again, and probably all the folks online receive regularly my email notice of these. That also includes the archive, link to the archives, and the link to upcoming talks. If folks have ideas for upcoming speakers, topics, and so on, please feel free to get in touch with me. So have a good rest of your day.